it amid a hard rain of falling seawater, Forest Spear grunting as he came down a few feet away. They both scrambled to their feet and rushed towards the door, then reared back as the walkway to the left of the lighthouse crumbled and collapsed into a white torrent of water. The western casement holding the harbor door in place had vanished, and the door itself blasted aside. The force of the two moon tides soon tore the door away completely, before sweeping on into the harbor. The ships, Cirrus thought, watching the harbor waters rise, taking the vessels with them as they deluged the quayside and the warehouses beyond. The inrushing tide didn't stop there, swallowing the mercantile district north of the docks, the ships it carried adding to the destruction as their iron hulls tore buildings into flotsam. He could see bodies amongst the surging fury of the flood, thousands of bodies, all spoiled and all screaming in confusion in his mind before they blinked into the void.
"I'm sorry,"
Kathleen said, red-black eyes downcast and face tense with genuine regret. Then she sent a bolt of purest agony into Cirrus's mind. He was no stranger to torture, and had considered the torments visited upon him by the Imperial Carder to be the worst pain he was ever likely to endure. He had been wrong. His body bent taut like a bow, jaws clamped together so tight he couldn't even scream as he convulsed. His mind fragmented under the weight of agony, rationality disappearing into a jumbled haze of discordant memory, glimpsed only for an instant, before the pain took them away. There was one image he managed to hold on to longer than the others. Takela's face. The scorn she had shown him in Mooresvale, the pity in Theros, and the fear as she looked upon Katarius. Her face became his savior, like the wreckage he had clung to after the battle with the iron ship cruiser, a single point of comfort in the storm of pain. When it ended, he found himself lying on the floor of Kathleen's ballroom, one half of his face damp from the drool that had gushed from his lips. The relief was almost like pain in itself, being such a jarring contrast to what he had just endured, and he found he had to choke down a scream.
"Even if we could refloat the ships," he heard Moradin say, "without a working harbor, Subarisk is useless as a port."
"Tell me at least that you caught that fucking ship," Kathleen said.
"The Blues gave chase, but she was so confounded fast."
Moradin's voice was controlled, but possessed of a wary tone, as if expecting his own bout of punishment at any second.
"The Blues tracked it south for a time, but it seems they can't swim faster than a blood burner, at least not this one."
Kathleen let out a sigh of exasperation.
"How can just one shell from one ship destroy an entire city?"
"It wasn't a shell,"
Cirrus said, grimacing as he got to his feet.
"It was a rocket."
The Council of War were standing a few feet away, each one maintaining a carefully neutral visage, except for Kathleen, who offered him a brief, relieved smile.
"He wanted to feed you to his brood," she said in his mind. "I persuaded him otherwise, told him you were still our best hope for victory. Don't prove me a liar, General."
"A rocket,"
Moradin said, heavy brows bunched in doubt.
"Never seen one with that kind of range or that kind of punch."
"Clearly, this one is something new,"
Cirrus replied, straightening his tunic and moving to Kathleen's side.
"Launched out of range of our guns during a two-moon tide, and not aimed at the harbor door itself, but the sea just in front of it. Water has a strange effect on explosions. At depth, the pressure greatly magnifies their power. Even a comparatively small amount of explosive would have achieved the same result, provided it was placed with sufficient accuracy." He paused, scaled brows raised in reluctant admiration. Miss Lethbridge is either very clever or has some very clever friends.
He turned his gaze to Veilmist.
Casualties. 20,642 spoiled dead,
she replied, prompt as ever.
Plus 5,200 captives who hadn't yet been converted. Also,
she shot a guarded look at Kathleen.
223 greens and 18 reds.
So few, Cirrus thought, masking his regret with fear. The fleet, he asked instead.
We have 5 ships in working order, only 1 a warship.
Cirrus looked at Moradin, who kept his face rigid, although their shared minds reached the same conclusion.
So, an invasion of Verestia is now impossible,
Kathleen said, reading their thoughts.
Not for several months,
Cirrus replied. At least not by sea. There is one alternative.
A land invasion,
Moradin elaborated.
We march overland to the Verestian Peninsula. There are numerous towns and villages en route where more recruits can be harvested.
What's to stop our enemies simply sailing away?
Kathleen inquired.
We can assume the Verestians will stay and defend their homeland,
Cirrus said.
And since it seems clear that Miss Lethbridge is now allied with them, so will she. You assume a great deal, General. With Verestia in our hands, we will have all the ships we'll need.
Enough ships to carry this army to every corner of the world. Kathleen fell silent, her face taking on the unfocused blankness that told of communion with the White. From outside came a roar, rich in frustration, and loud enough to shake the windows. Kathleen began to tremble as the roar descended into a low growl that persisted for some time. Eventually it faded, and she let out a gasp, falling to her knees, shuddering. Cirrus crouched at her side, placing a tentative hand on her shoulder, feeling the flesh tremble beneath her shawl.
We,
she began, voice faltering into a cough. Kathleen swallowed and spoke on.
We have leave to march on Verestia, but he wishes to educate our army first.
Cirrus's gaze snapped to Moradin as the marshal let out a strangled yell and collapsed to the floor, swiftly followed by Veilmist, Forest Spear, and the other spoiled present. Only Cirrus and Kathleen remained immune. From beyond the windows came a strange murmuration, the massed discordant chorus of thousands of souls thrashing in pain, but unable to scream. Cirrus moved to the window, knowing what he would see. He could feel their pain and confusion, his entire army lying amidst the ruined streets of Subarisk, convulsing beneath the weight of the White's punishment.
He promises so much,
Kathleen said, moving to join him at the window. Cirrus felt her hand slip into his, grasping it tight.
But great works require great sacrifice.
Chapter 28. Clay.
The Karnstadt Mountains were less tall than the Coppersols, but somehow more threatening in appearance. They rose in sheer-sided monoliths from a thick blanket of encroaching jungle, flanks shrouded in drifting mist. The company had already spotted their first black the day before, a youthful female, according to Skagahill's experienced opinion. They had dismounted from their final Sarath ride the previous morning and spent the next 2 days trekking through the increasingly verdant plains north of the mountains. The black appeared at noon, a dark silhouette in the sky that circled them well out of long rifle range before flying off to the south.
Guess they know we're coming,
Clay said, watching the drake fade into the distance.
Think she's gonna go tell her folks they got visitors?
Skagahill said, a note of humor in his voice that faded when he saw Clay's expression.
Yeah, Clay told him.
That's exactly what I think she's gonna do.
They're still animals,
Skagahill insisted, a certain stubborn sullenness creasing his brow.
It's a mistake to imagine they think like us, talk like us.
These ain't the dumb beasts you imagined them to be all these years, Clay replied. You gotta know that after everything we've seen. And no, they don't think like us or talk like us, but they do think. He turned his gaze to the south once more, the black now no more than a speck above the mountains cresting the horizon. And they do talk. The plains gave way to sparse forest as they neared the mountains, which soon grew into thick jungle. Clay called a halt with the onset of evening, when they settled down to eat a meal of roasted Serath meat. Whilst the others talked over their options, Clay sat in silent contemplation of the map Heilmor had given him.
Climbing the first mountain we come to seems like the best bet, his uncle said. Find us a nesting drake, and Miss Kriz can do what she does with the crystal. Females don't fly when they're nesting. You think they'll let us get anywhere near a nest, Captain? Skagahill said. Nesting female will be sure to have a big, mean male close by, who's likely to roast us before we manage to scale more than a few feet. I say we do what we did last time, except we try for a capture instead of a kill. Preacher will shoot us some game and we leave the carcass out in a clearing. Black will come along sooner or later, most likely a young'un as they're less wary than the adults. Be easier to rope up too, since they're smaller. After that, the lady can do her thing, and, Skagahill shrugged. I guess we'll see if and it works.
Worth a try, I guess, Braddon said after some thought. Be right tricky, though. Might end up killing any beast we catch, given how they can be.
No,
Clay interrupted, looking up from his map. We ain't doing any of that.
Then what do you suggest, cuz?
Lauriabeth asked.
We all just go strolling on in there and wait for one to come say hello.
Not all.
Clay scanned them with a steady gaze, making sure they all understood his next words to be sincere and not subject to argument.
Just me and Kriz. The rest of you are going to skirt the mountains and make for the coast. I'll trance with the lieutenant along the way to let you know how we're doing. If I don't trance for 3 days straight, head for Stockholm. Lauriabeth let out a disparaging laugh, quickly echoed by his uncle.
Clay, if you think I'm going to let you walk in there on your own...
They remember!
Braddon fell silent, his laughter fading as Clay's shout echoed through the jungle.
Drakes ain't like us, like I said,
Clay went on, voice lowered.
One thing that makes them different is their memory. It don't die with them. They carry it. Every black holds the memory of its parents and its grandparents and their grandparents, going all the way back for thousands of years. You've been here before, so they know your scent and they know what you did. They'll kill you.
I ain't been here before, Lauriabeth said. I should come too.
You carry your pa's scent, cuz, Clay said, shaking his head. I ain't risking it.
Braddon began to say something more, but Clay cut him off.
It's settled, uncle. You made me captain. Well, I'm giving orders. You head for the coast.
He turned to Kriz. We'll set off in the morning, if you're willing. He detected a slight hesitation before she replied with a nod and a forced smile.
Of course. There was a city here in my time. I'm keen to see if there's anything left of it.
They parted the next morning, after a brief farewell that saw Lauriabeth fighting tears and Braddon make a last and fruitless attempt to persuade Clay to another course of action.
Course is set, uncle, he replied,
turning to walk away before pausing for a second to add,
and don't try tracking after us.
To be certain, He called a halt after he and Chris had covered the first few miles, and waited, hearing and seeing no sign that they were being followed.
"Is it true?"
Chris whispered as they crouched in the undergrowth.
"What?"
Clay asked.
"About Drake memory. It's not just something you told them to spare them danger."
"Course not." He turned to her, frowning in realization. "You didn't know?" Her face took on a sheepish grimace.
"Clearly we had much left to discover."
"Seems to me the more I find out about your people, the more dumb they seem. You didn't know how the crystals work, but you used them anyway. You didn't know what the wipe was capable of, but that didn't stop you breeding the damn thing. Also, turns out you barely know shit about the animals you spent years studying."
"All knowledge is
precious and dangerous. Yeah, I remember." Clay waited for a few moments more, and, satisfied they were in fact traveling alone, rose and resumed the southward trek towards the nearest mountain. He stopped when he realized Chris wasn't following, turning back to find her standing with her gaze averted, hands fidgeting on the straps of her back.
"What?"
he asked her.
"Thousands of years," she said. "Their memory goes back thousands of years."
"So?"
"So,"
she raised her gaze, eyes wary with reluctant admission.
"So, they might well remember me. Remember what I did all those years ago."
Clay took a step towards her, finding his voice had hardened when he spoke on.
"What you did?" "Experiments."
She closed her eyes and let out a heavy sigh.
"Dissections."
Clay came to a halt, and they stared at each other for a time, Chris forcing herself to meet his eyes, Clay realizing the depth of his ignorance about this woman.
"As you said,"
she went on, breaking a lengthy silence,
"we barely knew shit about them."
"We can still find the others,"
he said in a flat, weary voice, starting back down the trail.
"You'll go with them."
"No."
She was emphatic, unmoving.
"No. You need me to activate the crystal. If they remember, then we'll just have to hope the crystal conveys sufficient understanding for them to hear a heartfelt apology." "Do we climb?"
Chris asked, her voice betraying an ill-concealed reluctance as she gazed up at the granite flanks of the mountain. A thick mist concealed the summit, and, although the cliff face before them featured numerous ledges and cracks, Clay found the prospect of climbing it distinctly unappealing. He glanced around at the jungle canopy surrounding the low, grassy hill where they stood. Once clear of the jungle, the air took on a clammy chill, adding to the sense of exposure. The clouds that seemed to linger constantly over the mountains could conceal any manner of threats, and Clay was beset by a persistent sense that a dark-winged shape would come swooping out of the white sky at any moment.
"No," he said, unslinging his pack. "We'll camp here tonight. Keep moving south come the morning."
"There's no cover,"
she pointed out, casting a hand at the sky.
"That's kind of the point. We want to be found, remember?"
He set his pack down, resting a hand on the bulbous shape within.
"Come a long way, young'un,"
he thought, smoothing his palm over the egg's grainy shell. "Hope your kin are pleased to see you." They took turns on watch through the night, which proved uneventful if somewhat tense. Like all jungles, this one generated a nerve-straining chorus of combined animal chatter and creaking branches. The only potential sign of a drake came during Clay's watch in the small hours when the night was blackest. The clouds parted for a short time, allowing a patch of moonlight to play over the jungle. Clay gazed at the pale blue light playing on the treetops, making them glitter as it caught the innumerable leaves, then started as a swift shadow swept across the scene. His gaze jerked upwards, honed instincts making one hand reach for his revolver, whilst the other went to his wallet of product. He checked himself and forced his hands back into his lap, eyes roving the sky as the clouds closed in again. He heard no drake call, nor flap of wings, but the feeling of being observed raised a prickle to his skin. "I know you're up there," he whispered, hearing the quaver in his voice. "Why not come say hello?" His hand went to the vials around his neck, the fruits of his sojourn in the enclave beneath the ice. White blood and black heart blood, the existence of which he had chosen to keep from Captain Heilmore. He hadn't explicitly told Lizanne either, but, given her facility for trance communication, it was possible she already knew. Once again, the notion of drinking white played through his mind. "It might show me where to go," he thought. "Where to find them." The vial's contents were dark, catching only a marginal gleam from the campfire. With no plasmologist dilutions to preserve it, the blood had congealed, making it appear a thick, oily sludge he knew would be the foulest thing he had ever tasted. "Only when everything else has failed," he decided, letting it fall from his grasp and turning his gaze on the vial of heart blood. It was similarly congealed, but even darker. The pain of drinking the blue heart blood still lingered in his mind. Also, he knew now the connection was not inevitable. This was not a magic potion from some fable that would cast a spell over any drake he chose. It allowed the joining of minds, and his control over Jack had been possible only because the drake's mind had been fractured and susceptible to remolding. Miss Ethlyn had forged a connection with Lutheron, but he had been an infant at the time. Somehow he doubted a sane adult black would present an easier prospect. "Another last resort," he concluded, concealing the vials beneath his shirt and looking at his pack and the round shape within. "Looks like it'll be down to you, young'un." They moved on come the morning, Clay following a course that would lead them into the heart of the Karnstads. The jungle was similar to the country east of Crystalline Lake, though the trees were less tall and the ground-level vegetation thicker. He was wary at first, recognizing this as perfect green country, and walking with his revolver drawn. He holstered it after trekking for several hours, during which he saw no claw tracks on the jungle floor, or any of the markings greens habitually left on tree trunks to mark their territory. "Not green country," he thought, peering up at the sky through the canopy. "They steer well clear of this place. This is black country." "So, what was it called?" he asked Chris when they paused in a clearing some miles on. "The city that used to sit here."
"Devos Illusica," she said,
speaking in her own language, as they both did most of the time now.
"It means the divine tree."
She gave a wistful sigh as she gazed around at the enclosing wall of jungle.
"It was beautiful, Clay. An entire city built by a subsect of the Devos caste. They chose to build without the aid of any crystals, in fact shunning their use entirely, believing the benefactors had sent them as a test rather than a gift."
"A test?" Clay asked. "Of what?"
"It's all a little confused," she said,
drinking from her canteen and frowning in remembrance.
"But then I always had trouble comprehending the vagaries of the Devos. It had something to do with our worthiness, our value as a species. They felt we had lessened ourselves by using the crystals, become as pampered children in the eyes of the benefactors. Only by rebuilding our civilization with our own hands could we win back their favor. Otherwise, they were sure to punish us with a great cataclysm of some kind."
"Maybe they had a point, given what was coming and all."
They were hypocrites. The city they built here was small at first, just a series of interlinked houses crafted to sit amongst the treetops in supposed harmony with nature. But as time went on, it grew taller, coming to resemble a great tree itself, adorned with glowing baubles when night fell. But they would never have been able to build it without the engineering knowledge acquired since the dawn of the Crystal Age. And as the decades passed, successive generations crafted convenient sophistry to enable them to use crystals, eventually forgetting their heresy altogether, and the great tree grew ever taller. In my time, it rose higher than some of the mountains.
She paused, voice becoming somber, and her fond smile fading.
It must have been quite a sight when it fell.
Clay was about to ask more, then stopped, when his gaze alighted on something in the gloom beyond Chris's shoulder. The firelight playing on the outline of a crouched figure. He scrambled to his feet, drawing his revolver, Chris doing the same.
What is it?
She whispered, moving to his side.
Company.
Clay trained his revolver on the outline, eyes flicking left and right for any sign of another intruder, seeing only darkened jungle. After several long seconds in which nothing happened, he began to discern the unnatural stillness of the crouched figure. Even a spoiled couldn't sit still for that long, he decided, nevertheless keeping the revolver aimed at the figure as he crept closer.
See your damn statue,
he muttered in relief as the figure came fully into view. The statue was cracked and mostly covered with vines. However, enough of its original form remained to make out the shape of a kneeling man, hands clasped together, but head raised to stare directly ahead.
Spoiled,
Clay said, running a hand over the statue's scaled features, feeling the stunted spines on its forehead. He was no scholar of the arts, but there was something familiar about the way the stone had been worked, the sharp angles and blockiness of the statue, putting him in mind of the hidden city near Crystalline Lake. But there were also subtle differences, a more curved line than he had seen before, and, as a quick inspection of the statue's base confirmed, it had been decorated with a markedly different form of writing. The characters adorning the statues in the hidden city had a flowing, almost organic quality, whilst these were much more regular and dense, almost like words in a printed book.
Miss Ethy might have been able to read it, he murmured,
running a hand over the inscription.
Who?
Chris asked. A friend of mine. She died, and I was too dumb to look at her notebooks when I had the chance.
Oh.
She reached out to smooth a hand over the statue's upper arm.
Finally worked. Whoever made this was very skilled, but there was nothing like it in my time.
Yeah, I guessed it didn't come from your holy tree city. Clay straightened as something occurred to him. Where there's one, there'll be more. He extracted a vial of green from his wallet and drank a small amount, casting his gaze about at the revealed jungle.
There,
he said, pointing as his enhanced gaze picked out another crouching figure some 20 yards away. A brief inspection revealed it to be mostly identical to the first one, albeit with a greater level of damage. Further investigation revealed another 2 statues farther on, each spaced at what seemed to be precisely the same distance.
And there's another one,
Clay said, nodding to the next figure in what was clearly a long line of statues.
Looks like we got a trail to follow come the morning.
They counted over 200 statues by the time the trail ended in a broad clearing about 3 miles from where they had camped. They changed in form as the trail continued, the kneeling figures rising to a crouch, then standing, then with arms stretched out in front. Clay began to suspect they were in fact looking at a sequence depicting the same spoiled, captured at different stages in some kind of ritual.
The final statue was the most damaged of all. The head was gone, and half the figure's vine-enmeshed torso had tumbled into dust long ago. One outstretched arm remained, however. The hand closed into a fist, with a stunted finger extended. The artisan's memory, he realized, following the direction of the pointed finger. They were in the same clearing from the memory Lisanne had shared with him, but instead of the statue pointing to a jagged outline above the treetops, it pointed only at empty sky. Must have fallen to ruin since, he murmured.
What must have? Chris asked.
A temple, he said, starting forward. This way. He staggered as a gust of wind swept down from above, raising enough dust to blind him, whilst his ears were assailed by the roar of an enraged drake. A shudder ran through the ground as a large black descended directly to his front, wings spread wide and mouth open. More shudders followed in quick succession, Clay whirling to see two more blacks landing to their rear.
The crystal,
Clay said, and Chris immediately reached into her pocket. The black to their front let out a squawk of alarm at this, lowering itself into a crouch, smoke rising from its nostrils.
Hey!
Clay raised both arms, presenting his empty hands to the black, hoping to buy time for Chris to activate the crystal.
We're friends! See? No weapons! And we brought a gift!
He unshouldered his pack, swiftly undoing the ties and extracting what was inside.
Peace offering, he said,
setting the egg down in front of the black. Its aggressive posture didn't change, though it did lower its gaze a fraction to take in the sight of the egg. Letting out a suspicious grunt, the black dipped its head to sniff the egg, puffing in what Clay took for recognition.
Young'un needs a new home, he said. Brung him a long way to find it.
The black's eyes narrowed, a low guttural rumble sounding from its throat as it enclosed the egg in its claw, dragging it back as it hissed in warning. Clay watched as the beast's gaze tracked from him to Chris, where it lingered, narrowed further, then flared into a deep, angry recognition.
Shit,
he thought, turning and dragging Chris into a protective huddle as the black roared and unleashed its flames. Chapter 29 Lisanne.
You were right,
Lisanne told Captain Tremaine.
Mrs. Griffin is not suited to service aboard your ship.
Tremaine glanced to where Sophia was fussing over some of the children, her face showing a rare animation and joy.
The mission was a success, he said. I believe she acquitted herself well.
She should have passed on my order to abort, Lisanne insisted. We were compromised.
Wartime operations are not intelligence missions, Miss Lethbridge.
Tremaine's tone was mild, but his gaze betrayed a twitch of resentment she realized came from her use of the word order.
They cannot be abandoned due to mere compromise, Tremaine went on. War is an exercise in the management and acceptance of risk. If Mrs. Griffin had passed on your order, I may well have discounted it in any case, considering the advantage we stood to gain. A seaborne invasion of the Red Tides is now impossible, at least for some considerable time. In short, the risk was worth it.
Is it pride? Lisanne wondered, trying not to let her burgeoning anger show on her face. That makes me dislike this man so. Do I hunger for power? Like Countess Sefka or the Electress? Despite her resentments, she knew there was merit in his judgment. It was 2 days since the viable opportunity had returned from its mission, during which time Takayla and Lisanne had made a brief reconnaissance flight. They flew in daylight with Morva and a volunteer from the militia, both armed with mini-growlers. They kept a wary eye on the surrounding sky, as the aerostat drew close enough to Subarisk to confirm it mostly ruined by flooding and the White's fleet wrecked, save for a few vessels seen floating in the harbor. More disturbingly, there was no sign of any drakes, or, as they drifted lower, no spoiled either. Lizanne had decided to risk an inland flight, having Morva stand by to ignite the Bloodburner as they flew north. The tail end of the White's army came into view some 10 miles beyond the city, the huge host raising a pool of brownish dust as it snaked away across the landscape. The sight of dark-winged specks flying above the horde was enough to convince Lizanne to turn back. The conclusion was obvious. The White had abandoned Subarisk and commenced an overland march. Its eventual destination was not hard to divine. They had won victory and precious time, but this war was very far from over.
"Ah," Trumaine said, turning towards her father's workshop, as a sudden upsurge in noise rose from beneath the awning. "I believe we are about to be treated to an unveiling."
The workforce had been granted the afternoon off to witness this event, a reward for exceeding their production targets, and also a pragmatic measure intended to obviate the exhaustion of many. The patch of bare ground that lay in front of the workshop had been converted into a park of sorts, complete with benches and gravel paths. Some former gardeners from Lossamark had even planted flower beds, though it would be some weeks before they blossomed. It was mainly used as a playground, carpenters and metal workers having used their infrequent spare time to construct swings and a climbing frame for the children. Today the park was crowded with off-duty workers, mostly clad in their overalls, though Lizanne saw some who had taken the time to change into finer garb, somehow salvaged from their previous lives. Despite the tiredness evident on most faces, there was a distinct sense of celebration in the air, as if the unveiling of the professor's latest marvel might even be a cause for optimism. The noise from the workshop rose to a greater pitch, sounding to Lizanne like the buzzing of 1,000 giant hornets. Ripples spread across the awning, and it began to snap with increasing energy before the ties holding it in place were either deliberately undone or it was torn away by the gale raging beneath. As the awning peeled back from the workshop's roof, a large curved shape began to rise, drawing an awed gasp from the onlooking crowd. Lizanne had expected the Mark II aerostat to be larger than the Firefly, but this was on another scale entirely. The gas envelope that rose from the workshop was at least 4 times the size of the Firefly and different in shape. Instead of an elongated egg, it put Lizanne in mind of a headless whale being flatter and wider. Also, its smooth surface was broken by a cupola on its topside. She instantly recognized her father's tall form standing in the cupola, giving a hesitant wave as a cheer rose from the crowd at the sight of him. 4 rudders protruded from the stern, 2 vertical and 2 horizontal, swiveling in response to Takela's touch on the controls. The aerostat rose higher, the source of the great buzzing noise soon revealed as 2 propelling engines fitted to either side of the gondola that seemed to sprout like some organic growth from the craft's underside. The engines were angled so that the propellers pointed at the ground, blurred to invisibility as they pushed the aerostat higher still, drawing it clear of the workshop. It slowed to a hover, some 50 feet off the ground, at which point the spectators all burst into applause.
"Impressive," Captain Tremaine said,
Lizanne turning to see a corner of his mouth curling in an infrequently seen expression of pleasure, or perhaps anticipation.
"I wonder if it can lift a rocket."
"It looks like a whale," Morva said. "That's what we should call it, the flying whale." "We're not calling her that,"
Takela insisted.
"She's the Typhoon. I'm the pilot, so I get to name her."
She turned to Lizanne with an expectant smile.
"Isn't that so?"
I couldn't care less if you call her the Flying Turd, Lizanne said, as long as she performs as expected.
A gaze tracked over the interior of the gondola. After a brief circuit of the mount, the new aerostat had been tethered to one of the taller chimneys. Lizanne, Morva, and Tremaine had climbed a rope ladder for an inspection. She estimated the compartment was sufficiently spacious for at least a dozen crew, with wide hatches in the hull to which gun mountings had already been fitted.
She can carry 2 thumpers or 5 growlers,
Professor Lethbridge said, descending a ladder which extended from the center of the floor into an opening in the ceiling.
Or a mix of the two, plus another growler in the upper observation point.
A clever modification, Father, she complimented him. Drakes do like to attack from above.
It might not be entirely necessary, Captain Tremaine put in, glancing up from an inspection of the control panel at the front of the gondola. Is this altitude indicator's maximum level accurate, Grayson?
A reasonable estimation based on the lifting capacity, the professor replied.
There will be variations depending on atmospheric conditions, of course.
10,000 feet, Captain Tremaine said, tapping one of the dials. I'm no Drakeologist, but I believe no red has ever been observed to fly higher than 6,000 feet. Something to do with the thinness of the air, I believe.
Speed?
Lizanne asked her father, although it was Takela who answered.
On standard power, we think she might get up to 80 miles per hour, she said. 2 engines, you see? Once the blood burners are lit, however, she smiled. Well, I'm very keen to find out just how fast she'll go.
So, Lizanne mused, moving to one of the gun mountings.
We have the advantage of height, speed, and firepower.
Whilst they possess greater numbers, Tremaine pointed out. One ship doesn't make a fleet.
With the materials already on hand,
Professor Lethbridge said after a moment's mental calculation,
we could produce perhaps 2 a month.
That won't be enough, Lizanne said. Destroying the White's ships has bought us time, but we can expect its army to reach the Verestian Peninsula within 4 to 5 weeks.
Growing larger with every village and town it destroys along the way, she added to herself.
It's a matter of labor rather than resources, her father said. With an expanded workforce.
You'll have it, she promised. It'll mean reduced production of weapons, but that can't be helped. Without more of these, I doubt we have a chance.
She turned to Takela.
I'm appointing you chief pilot. Your first task is to identify and train others in how to fly this thing.
Takela's face took on a puzzled frown.
How do I do that? Find people with relevant experience. Former helmsmen, locomotive drivers and the like. Madam Hackigan should be able to help. Failing that, just ask people to volunteer. I'm sure there are many keen to get out of the manufactory.
She turned to her father.
Captain Tremaine voiced a pertinent question earlier, she said. Regarding rockets.
Afilda and Arshav convened their war council in the observation tower crowning the navigation. Lizanne had arrived alone in the Firefly an hour before, piloting it herself to land on the building's expansive front lawn. Mr. Lockbar and his gang duly arrived, failing to deliver a formal greeting of any kind, before conducting a thorough and ungentle search of her person for product and weapons. He then escorted her to the meeting, where Lizanne was surprised to find Alzar Lakaris in attendance, along with a half-dozen captains of varying clan allegiances. Athilda hadn't bothered to introduce any of the captains, though a few possessed sufficient manners to make themselves known to Lizanne before the meeting began. The most courteous was a trim woman clad in a long waxed canvas jacket and sea boots, the least expensive garb of any other captain present. She was about Lizanne's height and build,
and would have seemed much the same age, but for her hair and lined face.
Miriam Cashiel, she said,
removing her broad-brimmed hat and performing a low bow.
Captain of the Sunrider and Chief of Clan Cashiel.
Lizanne Lethbridge.
Oh, I know who you are. They call you Miss Blood.
The woman straightened with a grin.
But I won't. Bit of a silly name, don't you think?
Extremely. I didn't choose it.
Got our first delivery of your marvelous guns yesterday. Very impressive, especially the big ones. Could do with a lot more, though.
They're on their way,
Lizanne assured her.
If you're finished with your chatter,
Arshav broke in, eyes hard, and face set in as serious an expression as Lizanne had yet seen.
We have a war to plan.
He turned to Ithilda as the room fell silent.
Mother?
Ithilda moved to stand next to the oil painting, depicting the Verestian region. She held a thin ivory baton and wore a dress which had been adorned with various military accoutrements, including shoulder epaulettes and a yellow sash of the kind worn by marshals of the late Mandalorian Imperium. Lizanne somehow knew Ithilda was already imagining the portrait of her in this dress that would one day adorn the halls of this building.
Subarisk,
Ithilda said, tapping the tip of the baton to the relevant section of the painting.
Fallen to our enemy and since abandoned, thanks to an unsanctioned action by our supposed ally.
She fixed Lizanne with a glare before moving the baton westward.
Denied ships, the enemy is now marching towards the peninsula.
Where they will no doubt visit all manner of vile havoc on every Verestian they get their claws on,
Arshav added. Unlike his mother, he didn't glare, though Lizanne recognized the set of his features, having seen the face of many a man set on murder.
Subarisk,
Lizanne decided, recalling Morva's words.
That will be their pretext.
With ships they would have invaded the Red Tides within days,
she pointed out, keeping her tone mild.
Now we have weeks to prepare. For a land campaign,
Ithilda said.
Verestians are not accustomed to fighting on land. At sea we would have had a much better chance of victory, especially with the new weapons.
A small murmur of agreement came from the other captains, though by no means all.
Many ships aren't yet armed, Al-Zalakaris said,
voice flat, though his animosity to his cousins shone in his eyes clearly enough.
And there are only a few hundred of the new carbines. I also note my cousin Arshav has barely managed to gather more than 10,000 fighters. I can't be held accountable for the cowardice of others, Arshav said,
a snarl creeping into his voice.
It isn't cowardice, cousin, Alzar replied. It's you. No true Verestian wants the stain on their honor that comes from serving under your flag. Careful, cousin,
Arshav returned, his hand straying towards the hilt of his saber.
Challenges may be forbidden in time of war, but don't imagine that will protect you.
Alzar met Arshav's gaze squarely, a sneer forming on his lips.
From what?
Enough!
Ithilda barked, as Arshav's fist closed on the saber hilt.
This avails us nothing.
She focused her gaze on Lizanne.
We have a disloyal ally to deal with.
Lizanne had prepared an initial response to this trap, a short but effective speech, highlighting Arshav's and Ithilda's many and obvious faults in both character and judgment. It was designed to stoke the pre-existing resentments of the other captains, perhaps even to the point where they might be tempted to stage a coup. But the O'Canis' clumsy intrigues were proving sufficiently tiresome for her to proceed directly to the alternative option.
I take it Mr. Lockbar is outside awaiting some form of signal,
she said, arching a quizzical eyebrow at Ithilda.
Soon he'll come bursting in to arrest me for breach of contract.
whereupon I'll be marched off to some dungeon, perhaps making a doomed and fatal escape attempt along the way.
Ithilda stared at her with an expression that mingled poorly hidden surprise with unconcealed animosity, her eyes flicking towards Arshav as they exchanged an uncertain glance. Bazan gave a disgusted sigh and strode towards the large telescope opposite the huge oil-painted map. She swiveled the tube on the tripod to point it towards the large window, setting the correct angle before checking the focus through the eyepiece.
"Please," she said, stepping back and gesturing at the telescope. "I should like you to see my father's latest invention," she added, as mother and son exchanged another glance.
They continued to stand in rigid and enraged immobility, so Alzar stepped forward.
"What is that?" he asked,
brows creasing as he squinted through the eyepiece.
"She's called the Typhoon," Lizanne replied. "A Mark II aerostat, currently hovering at a height of 6,000 feet, well outside the range of any current artillery piece. Please note the object below the gondola."
"I see it," Alzar said, after some more squinting.
"We call that the Tinkerer Mark I rocket. It's identical to the one that destroyed the harbor door at Subarisk. You will also note it is aimed directly at this building. Should I fail to fly away from the seven walls within the hour, it will be fired. And please harbor no illusions that it will miss its target."
She turned to Ithilda and Arshav, speaking in clear, precise tones to ensure there would be no mistaking her intent.
"Our contract is hereby voided on grounds of corporate duplicity and negotiations undertaken in bad faith. Should you make any attempt to reassert the provisions of said contract, the Typhoon will return and destroy this building. It will then destroy every ship your family owns. The Mount Works Manufacturing Company is, of this moment, a separate entity and free to negotiate its own contracts. Your business, however, is not welcome, and your authority over the Verestian region is no longer recognized."
She stepped away from the telescope and bowed to the other attendees.
"Captains, should you wish to engage in serious discussions regarding the defense of the Red Tides, you can find me at Blaska Sound. All munitions will be supplied free of charge to any who choose to ally with us."
She bowed again and moved to the door.
"Good day."
Chapter 30. Hylemore. "I'm sorry, Korrik, but you can expect no help." Hylemore reread the last line of the communique several times, it being the only sentence to convey any sense of intimacy. The rest of the missive contained a brief and depressing summary of recent events in Mandanore, and assurances that she had advised the Voters' Rights Alliance in this city to render assistance to him,
"subject to a reciprocal arrangement compatible with your honor."
This was followed shortly after by an observation he felt had been intended as much for his host's eyes as his.
"I'm sure all parties will benefit from your advice and calm counsel."
"So you see," Colt said after Hylemore had finished. "You want our help? You help us win this city back."
"That," Hylemore replied, "is not her intent."
"Reads that way to me,"
the stocky youth replied to a murmur of agreement from the other committee members.
"We got supplies. You want them. So take your boat across the harbor and pound that bitch Kolvetch's headquarters to rubble."
"That's not going to happen," Hylemore interrupted, glancing over the communique once more before consigning it to his pocket. Lacking intimacy or not, it was the only correspondence he had received from Luella in many months, and he found himself unwilling to part with it.
"You forget that I know Free Woman Tythoncroft far better than any of you. Her intention, misguided though I believe it to be, is for me to negotiate a ceasefire between the Voters' Rights Alliance and corporate forces,
and subsequently to assume leadership of this city. Eilmore rose from his stool, scanning each of the young, angry faces before him, and feeling far older than his 28 years. 29, he reminded himself, recalling his uncelebrated birthday on the ice. Clearly, he said, had she met Colonel Kolvetch or any of you lot, she would have known this to be a hopeless prospect, as is any further negotiation with me.
Wait,
Gillette said, as he started towards the door. Eilmore turned back, to find her on her feet exchanging hard glares with her fellow committee members. She snatched her arm away as Cole reached out to restrain her.
We need to know,
she hissed at him. Know what? Eilmore inquired.
Your report to Free Woman Tithencroft, she said. How much of it is true?
Eilmore had been circumspect in revealing full details of his eventful life since boarding the Viable Opportunity all those months ago, but saw little point in being overly secretive. His account had omitted the exact nature of the Long Rifle's mission to the interior, but confirmed its importance in resolving what he had termed the current emergency. Every word, he said.
So there's really an army of drakes and spoiled rampaging across the world?
Gillette persisted. Indeed, there is. We ain't seen 'em, Cole said.
How do we know this ain't all a pile of horseshit?
There is an entire fleet of merchant ships in your harbor terrified of putting to sea, Eilmore pointed out. Also, how long has it been since a contractor crew, or anyone else for that matter, turned up at the gates? More exchanging of glances, though much of the previous hostility had given way to uncertainty. The world is in chaos, Eilmore went on. Whilst you sit here indulging your petty squabbles and childish politics. I don't know why you've been spared so far, but sooner or later they will be coming for you. Still, he straightened his tunic and turned to leave once more. On the bright side, you may well have slaughtered each other before they get here.
Kolvetch won't sell to you lest you fight for her,
Cole called after him.
Where are you going to get your supplies?
Eilmore had to admit it was a good question. Although, as he made his way back to the wharf and the crowded harbor came into view, it occurred to him that there was in fact a third party in this port who might be open to more rational negotiation.
You want to sail away from the only safe port left on this continent?
Captain Tidlow asked, weathered brow creasing in doubt.
So's we can go off and fight in a war all the way across the ocean.
I do, Eilmore replied, voice raised so that all the other captains present could hear it. It appeared the master of every vessel in the harbor had come in answer to his invitation. So many, in fact, that he had been obliged to hold this conference on the superior's foredeck. This had the added benefit of ensuring that both Colonel Kolvetch and the voter rebels would be made fully aware of the proceedings. The captains were a mixed lot, North and South Mandanorian, Dalcian and Verestian, even a few Corventines. Some had charge of company vessels, but most were independents, and habitually inclined to resent corporate authority.
On whose say-so?
One of the other captains asked. A Dalcian woman of diminutive height, but with the bearing and the scars that told of a piratical past. I am issuing no orders, Eilmore said, merely appealing to reason and common sense.
Sailing off to fight a horde of drakes and spoiled doesn't sound particularly sensible,
one of the Corventine captains observed in accented but precisely spoken Mandanorian. He was a tall man with a studious look, though his salt-reddened cheeks bespoke many years at sea.
It took weeks of hard, perilous sailing to find a refuge for my ship and my crew, the Corventine went on. One, it will not be easy to persuade them to give up.
This is not a refuge, Arlmore told him. It's a trap, and you are snared here by your own delusions.